All right, so the sermon series that we're going through is Who is Jesus? Preaching out of Mark. And today we'll focus on a number of narratives related to food and cleanness. So let me jump right in to Mark chapter 6, verse 30. So the apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, "Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest for a while." For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in a boat to a desolate place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them, because they were like a sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of food?" And he said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they had found out, they said, "Five and two fish." Then he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass, all to sit down in groups. And so they sat down by 50s and hundreds. And taking the five loaves and two fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing, and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before all the people. And he divided the two fish among them all, and they all ate, and they were all satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. So Jesus and his disciples are tired and they've had little rest, with people following them from place to place, so little rest that they've hardly even had time to eat. So they take a boat to get away from the crowds. But a huge crowd shows up when they land. So change of plans. Jesus sees these people and he has compassion on them, because they are like a sheep without a shepherd. So he begins to teach them. And after teaching for some time, they need to eat. And then Jesus feeds them. Many thousands of people, 5,000, just counting the men. Likely 10 to 15,000, counting women and children. And everybody sits down. And Jesus multiplies five loaves and two fish into enough food for all of them, with leftovers. He feeds these people with his word, and then he feeds them physically with a meal of bread and fish. So already we begin to see some characteristics about Jesus. The hungry are drawn to him. Jesus is trying to get away, and thousands show up. And in this story, it's no wonder, right? What an incredible thing to witness. Likewise, as people are drawn to him, he's drawn to them. He sees people. He really sees people. When he sees people, he sees their need. And in this case, he shows great compassion throughout. Sometimes when I see people, I might see what they can do for me or what I could learn from them to better myself. Jesus seems to have this unique love for people and insight into people, so that, and this translates into him being able to see what they really need almost immediately. Finally, Jesus has some serious authority over the physical world. He's able to do miraculous things. So now let's jump into the next narrative, which again relates to food, the start of Mark chapter 7. Now when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of the disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands?" So, to recap, the Pharisees saw that Jesus' disciples were not following the cleanliness traditions. The Pharisees followed the laws and the traditions fervently. Pharisees are serious religious people, serious about law and tradition. They take cleanness very seriously. They don't seem to be too impressed or moved by Jesus' teaching generally, nor his miracles, and they certainly aren't impressed that Jesus' disciples don't seem to be following the cleanliness traditions. This could seem like a distant circumstance, zealous Jews talking about their own cultural traditions and laws. But we have our own traditions and worldviews. And we can be in that same position. I follow this good tradition. Why don't others? Why don't you? We're always noticing this kind of stuff. What was that guy thinking? Why didn't he behave the way that he should have? That wasn't right. That wasn't smart. That wasn't very nice. That wasn't respectful, that wasn't very impressive, that's not how I would have done it. And some of us may have been on the receiving end, identifying less with the Pharisees and more with the disciples, having someone look down on us for not following some tradition. Whether our own tradition that we aspire to or somebody else's tradition that they assumed would work for us. Either way, we may be able to see ourselves in the exchange up to this point. So let's pick up the narrative. The Pharisees have taken this tradition seriously, whereas the disciples have not. So from their morally advantaged position, the Pharisees brought a challenge against the disciples. Let's see how Jesus responds in verse 6. And he said to them, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.' You leave the commandment of God and hold to the tradition of men." And he said to them, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and your mother,' and 'Whoever reviles your father and mother must surely die.' But you say, 'If a man tells his father or his mother, whatever you would have gained from me is korban, that is given to God, then you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother, thus making void the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down, and many such things you do.'" Whoa. Jesus responds firmly. And he brings forth three criticisms of religion that you may be able to resonate with as well. The cleanness of the Pharisee is borderline unattainable. Laws, traditions, all these different ways of being clean, if the rules are specific enough to be useful, there are bound to be conflicts. how can somebody really follow all the traditions fully without running into conflicts? Religion seems to be nearly impossible. And then also the Pharisees pick and choose what traditions and laws they follow, often advantaging themselves. So religion can be used selfishly and selectively. And then finally, the cleanness of the Pharisee, looking back to the prior text, the cleanness of the Pharisee comes partly by contrast to the disciples. Part of why the Pharisees are so clean is because the disciples, because the crowds are not clean, unclean by contrast. So religion can come at the expense of others and at the expense of community. The Pharisees characterize the religious legalistic mindset, and Jesus undresses religion and religious behavior for what it so often is, selfish. Now let's see what else Jesus has to say in verse 14. And he called the people to him again and said to them, "Hear me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him." And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, "Then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him? Since it enters not from his heart, but from his stomach, and is expelled." Thus he declared all foods clean. And he said to them, "What comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person." Oftentimes, when things go wrong, we respond with the external. Something must be wrong with my circumstances. How can I change them? Something must be wrong with my behaviors. How can I change them? Something is wrong with the people around me. Something's wrong with the food that I'm eating. Something's wrong with my job, my routine, my hobbies. We try these external or cosmetic remedies. How has your weekend been so far? A coworker had once said of a former boss, "It was stressful, or at least a burden, to come in Monday morning and anticipate the how is your weekend recap. Oh, I did this fun social activity. I did an awesome job exercising. I went to this fun, cool, interesting event. I made an elaborate meal. I did some difficult project or some overdue cleaning." Tim Keller sharply characterizes author Frank Kafka's words as follows: "Though we've abandoned the ancient categories, we still have a profound sense, inescapable sense, that if we were examined, we'd be rejected." And you don't believe in sin, you don't believe in judgment, and you don't believe in guilt, and yet you know somehow you're unclean. We try to convince ourselves that nothing's wrong. But ultimately, when we're honest with ourselves, we likely have a sense that something is wrong, with our own experience affirming Jesus' words. The external remedies of the Pharisees and our contemporary analogs cannot make us clean, cannot satisfy, because they don't get at the problem, which is inside of us. So let's look at some different groups within the narrative and in the audience and see where they're onto something and where they're lacking. So the Pharisees, they were really serious about being clean. It turns out that they were right and wrong. The Pharisees saw the importance of cleanness, but didn't see how unclean they truly were, and underestimated how much more it would take for them to be clean. And their approach is all wrong. For all their work to be clean before God, Jesus sees that these pious, serious, religious people don't really have much love for God, that their hearts are far from God. You can't help but just see the striking irony of this narrative. Jesus is giving life-giving teaching. And the Pharisees seem to be concerned with petty traditions. Jesus demonstrates authority over the physical world and multiplies food. And the Pharisees want to know if everybody's hands were clean before they ate. Jesus turned 5 loaves and 2 fish into more than enough for thousands of people to eat and enjoy after hours of life-giving teaching. But if they didn't wash their hands, does that mean that they are unclean as they eat? You can sense the Pharisees' pride, condemnation, and fear, all wrapped up together. Israel's people are hungry. These religious and moral authorities, cultural authorities with their positions of power and their hollow teaching, left the people starving and unsatisfied. People today have noticed this sort of thing. Two characters came specifically to mind for me, the skeptic and the secular social justice warrior. Now, if this is you, you may see and be moved by the compassion of Jesus, the goodness of his teaching and his works, and so be attracted to Jesus, who he is and what he represents. And likewise, you're rightly repulsed by the Pharisee. You see the hunger of the masses. You see the religious elite as often indifferent to the needs and hunger of people. You see authorities using traditions and distinctions to elevate themselves, maintaining their own cleanness and control, causing pain and division at the expense of what is right and what is truly needed. On a trip this summer, I was introduced to a song by XTC, an English rock punk band that communicated this tone. The song starts, "Peter Pumpkinhead came to town, spreading wisdom and cash around, fed the starving and housed the poor, showed the Vatican what gold's for. But he made too many enemies of the people who would keep us on our knees." Right, this mindset, this tone is common. It's prevalent, and rightly so, because again, the Pharisee is repulsive, and in Christ we see a powerful contrast. To the skeptic and to the social justice warrior, Jesus is the figure that you have been looking for. He is, that you've been waiting for. Jesus knows the crowd. He knows their need. Jesus demonstrates care and compassion in meeting needs. Jesus harshly confronts abusive religious authorities. Jesus feeds the hungry and heals the sick, both physically and with his teaching. He declared all foods clean, dealing a blow to legalism. Jesus is what the skeptic and the secular social justice warrior have been waiting for. But he is more than what they have been waiting for. Two things that these characters and that we all must wrestle with: taking away religion and legalism and corruption and authority doesn't change the fact that we're still unclean. And then also, when when Jesus feeds, there are leftovers. And we'll come back to what that means. So one more narrative that again connects to food. Later in chapter 7, an unclean Gentile woman comes to Jesus asking for a demon to be cast out of her daughter. She and Jesus have an interesting exchange. Jesus says, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to throw the children's bread, take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." And he said to her, "For this statement you may go. The demon has left your daughter." And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. Jesus presses this woman, and she has a most excellent response. She approaches Jesus humbly, not regarding herself as one with authority to claim something that she is owed. Yet still, she approaches Jesus boldly and persistently. Keller restates her words as, "Give me what I don't deserve on the basis of your goodness. And I need it now." Her response, too, celebrates what is clearly communicated in the feeding of the 5,000 in chapter 6 and the 4,000 in chapter 8. In Jesus, there is nourishment and there will be leftovers. There were baskets left over from the feedings, and there will be crumbs that fall from the children's table. Jesus knows what we really need. Jesus is the nourishment for what we need, and there is enough for you and for all. The bounty of Jesus means that there is enough for you and for all. Like George mentioned in this first sermon, our instinct can be to make Jesus into something that we want, something that affirms our worldview. If we see Jesus as only a good teacher who cannot change and will not change anything in any sort of dramatic way, we're missing something. If we see Jesus as the healer of the masses of the sick who need not or will not heal us, we are missing something. If we see Jesus as someone who can feed the masses, but we insist we're not hungry, we are missing something. If we are eager for Jesus to confront the religious hypocrites, but we won't allow Jesus to confront the pride, hypocrisy, and evil in our own fleshly hearts, then we are missing something. If we are looking only for personal cleanness and satisfaction and fail to see that Jesus is bringing about a kingdom that's bigger than us, a kingdom where none will go hungry, then we are missing something. If we are looking for Jesus to mostly affirm the righteousness that we already have, then we are missing something. How is it that Jesus can declare all foods clean? How is it that Jesus can feed the hungry? How is it that Jesus can bring nourishment and healing to the unclean Gentile woman and her daughter, who on her own standing would have had no access to the table? Jesus was at the table and left. He was God in the flesh. He was at God's table in heaven, and he left. He had a righteousness beyond that of the Pharisees. He should have had a head seat at their table. But he left. Instead of using his authority and righteousness to hold himself up, affirm himself, making much of himself and less of others, he left the table and went to the cross. Later in the Gospels, Jesus serves communion to his disciples, giving them bread and wine that embodied the sacrifice that he would make on their behalf, saying, "Take this bread, this is my body broken for you, and take this wine, This is my blood shed for you. The Pharisee worried about whether eating with dirty hands would make one unclean. Jesus becomes the food that makes us clean. Jesus became the food that makes us clean. Jesus took our sin, took on our stain, took on our uncleanness so we could become clean. Think of the best meal that you've ever had, the most local, organic, fresh, or gluten-free ingredients. There's no shortage with plenty to eat, and nobody has to leave hungry or unsatisfied. Great venue with old friends and new friends. Great venue, a special context or occasion. Could be a wedding, summer barbecue outside. There is something so special about a great meal. We can't help but love a great meal. Now, communion specifically, and then this eating of Jesus generally, has the making of a great meal. To eat of something that will deeply fill and nourish our souls. To eat of food that will not destroy our bodies. In fact, when we eat of this food, we will be renewed in spite of our bodies, and someday we'll eat with Jesus with new bodies. We eat this meal in the context of both a rich diversity of different people and a deep shared experience. We eat this meal in celebration of what already is and what is to come. And there is plenty to eat. And this meal is free. What's better than a free meal with plenty to eat? Jesus picked up the tab and himself became the food. So, whether you're a skeptic or seeking, established believer, if you've been ignoring or hiding it, allow yourself to acknowledge your own hunger, your uncleanness. Don't pretend as though you're clean by nature, full and satisfied by your sufficient efforts. Even as Christians, we can do this functionally, even while trusting in the gospel mentally, cognitively. Draw toward the one, seek the one who knows your uncleanness and loves you nonetheless. Who knows your uncleanness because he paid for it. Who knows what you need and delivers it because he is God. Because he is king. And again, because he went to the cross to become our food. Especially if this is new to you and you want to know more, talk to someone this morning. Take communion, visit a house church, read Mark, pray to Jesus that he'd reveal himself to you. Take steps to encounter Jesus, taste of Jesus. To be clear, these need not be another hand-washing tradition by which we try and fail to secure our own righteousness, but rather mechanisms by which we can approach the one, this servant king, who has secured our cleanness, our meal, at great cost. The Pharisee's heart is far from God and is not moved by Jesus. The Pharisee was confident in their own righteousness, without blame and without need. If God is nothing but the one who hands us a paycheck at the end of our life for what we have rightly earned, which seems to be the mindset of the ancient and the modern Pharisee alike, in this case, it's not surprising that the Pharisee's relationship is characterized by a lack of love, as Jesus observes. God is just a bookkeeper giving us what is owed. By contrast, as we rightly see our need and rightly see the goodness of God and the sufficiency and abundance of Jesus' work in making us clean, in nourishing us, we will humbly draw nearer to Jesus and we will be fed. Let us eat of Jesus. There's enough of Jesus' body enough of Jesus' sacrifice and enough food in Jesus' kingdom for you, for me, for the hungry, for the full, for everybody. May you eat of Jesus. May we all eat of Jesus together. Let me pray. Lord, may you continue to clarify and impress these words in your word upon our heart. And in the words of Thomas Cranmer, we do not presume to come to this your table, merciful Lord, trusting in our own righteousness, but in your manifold and great mercies. We are not worthy so much as to gather up the crumbs under your table, but you are the same Lord whose property is always to have mercy. Amen.